America's first astronauts, known as the Mercury 7, were celebrities from the time that they were named in 1959 all the way into the 1970s, celebrated by the press and in books like Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff. Their wives had some moments of glory themselves when they were featured in Life magazine spreads, but otherwise they were limited to watching anxiously with the rest of the world as their husbands took off and landed on their missions. Lily Coppell tells their stories in her latest book, The Astronaut Wives Club, a true story. It's published by Grand Central. I'm very pleased it has brought Lily Coppell to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much.
You write that these wives were America's first reality stars. In what way?
I do. Well, basically, the space race kicks off on April 9th, 1959, and you have the Mercury 7 astronauts announced in Washington. And what's really funny about that first press conference is the press seems to be less interested in why Gus Grissom or, you know, Alan Shepard have volunteered to go into space, but it's more like, what does your wife have to say about this? And this is the question that's orbited throughout that press conference. And starting that day, reporters are dispatched across the country to meet their wives and see what they do have to say about it.
But we could kind of understand why the press was thinking that way. Most of us would not imagine wanting to go up in space, but we can imagine having a loved one do something that dangerous and wonder how we would react to it.
Right. I mean, you can look out your window any night and look up to the moon and think how surreal it would be to send your spouse up there. And that's exactly what I wanted to find out from these women. And in terms of the intensity of the media gaze on them, just jumping back to why I thought they were America's first reality stars, is Life magazine purchased exclusive access to their lives back in 59 for $500,000, which was an incredible amount coming
so
from
they
the
split
military
it
life.
Seven ways?
They did, yeah. And that basically meant that Life and a reporter photographer were embedded in the wife's home. All of the astronaut families during the height of the space race were living in the so-called space burbs outside of NASA's operations in Houston. Journalists knew it as Togethersville because of the tight-knit community.
And how much of this had to do with just the way America wanted to think of the ideal marriage?
Well, it had to do a lot with that. You know, I mean, you go back to, you know, that sort of Stepford Wives image from the 50s and the 60s. And even the wives today say to me when they're looking through their photo albums, wow, we look like Stepford Wives, you know, but we were so much more. But that was part of the pressure that was put on them by the American public. And I think about NASA as well, because it's the height of the Cold War. And these women are given the, you know, the challenge of keeping it cool, calm, and collected while their husbands are going into space, but also beaming that perfect American family image.
Although in one case, a marriage had kind of broken up, and they reunited because of that was the only way that he was going to wind up being named one of the Mercury 7.
Sure, that was Gordo and Trudy Cooper, and they had been separated before Gordo was picked as an astronaut, and he knew there was no way he was going to make that final selection without a happy little wife at home, so he goes out to Trudy and convinces her to get back together for the sake of the space race.
They had all sorts of things that they had to standards they had to meet before they were named. For example, they couldn't be over 5'11", and they had to be 180 pounds or less because of the tight spaces within the initial space capsules. And then they had to be happily married.
Right, exactly. I mean, one of the credos going back to the early days is basically if you don't have a happy marriage, you're not going to have a space flight. And oftentimes this ended up being sort of the burden of the wife, because as soon as these guys are made spacemen, I mean, you might as well have been called, they might as well have been called Superman, you know, and they're down at Cape Kennedy and they're being treated like rock stars. They're astronaut groupies that pop up overnight, known as Cape cookies. So, you know.
How serious a threat were they to these ideal marriages?
Well, a pretty big threat. And, you know, this is a very competitive environment. And all of the women acutely felt if they said anything that made their family look less than perfect, it could affect their husband's flight position.
Didn't one headline about Wally Schirra's return home read, "Astronaut's wife will bake a cake"? even though she didn't bake?
Yeah, that was really funny. Jo Sherrall was one of the women I, you know, sat down with and interviewed first off, and we spent 2 days, and I basically, you know, made her go through all of her photo albums, and she was like, oh, you know, if you dust them, you know. And anyway, we had a very fun time, but we're looking through all these headlines about how she's going to make him steak and cake when he comes back to Earth, and she was like, all he wanted when he came back was a cigarette. Because he had quit. All of the guys tried to quit because, you know, they didn't want to have a nicotine fit in orbit.
Scott Carpenter's wife, Reen, welcomed reporters and cameras into their home. She even dressed her daughters in matching outfits for the occasion because she felt that was the image that NASA wanted them to project.
Well, I think that you see in the spotlight seven very different women dealing with the press in a different way. And from being military wives, overnight their lives are basically turned inside out. All of a sudden they're going to be invited to the White House having tea with Jackie Kennedy. Reen Carpenter was someone from the beginning who really shone out. She had wanted to be a writer and an actress as a young woman. So basically when the reporters come to her home and they show up even before dawn, and it's almost like these headlights out on the side of her yard are almost like UFOs. They've come to discover her. And so she met with them with a great deal of, you know, grace and charm.
Although they went over two administrations initially because these men were selected during the Eisenhower administration, 500 applicants or so. And then the Kennedy administration was responsible for the big push.
Exactly. And
this is while Yuri Gagarin is orbiting Earth.
Exactly. You know, I mean, of course, you know, all the guys want to get into space first, and, you know, they're beaten to it by Gagarin. Eisenhower, though, wanted all the families initially to live in sort of a secret village, sort of like the cosmonauts in the Soviet Union, but was convinced by his advisors that the program should be out in the open. And that's why the wives were also offered as sort of fair game for the press as well as their families.
Why a secret village? I mean, I understand the secrecy in the Soviet Union, but did he feel that some Cold War secrets might somehow spill out if they were allowed to appear in public all the time?
Well, I think it wasn't a very good idea. So he was quickly convinced that they should be out on a platter ready for public consumption.
My guest is Lily Koppel, K-O-P-P-E-L, her latest book, The Astronaut Wives Club. How did Life magazine approach the Mercury 7 astronauts' wives?
Well, it was through their lawyer. After that first press conference on April 9th, they suddenly realized the sort of space fever that's built up around these guys and their families. And they realized there was no way they were really going to survive if this circus was upon them all of the time. For example, Betty Grissom, that first day Gus has announced, is chased down in the grocery store. She's just had a flu the night before. You know, lawns are trampled, you know, and the wives start talking about how things were that first day when they are just invaded, basically. So this was offered as sort of a protective device that the wives would only have to now go out on their lawns after their husband's flight. And their joke, their sort of motto, which Reen Carpenter came up with, was happy, proud, and thrilled. And it was always, how do you feel when your husband's up on the rocket? And the wives thought, wow, if I say what I really felt, that I'm nauseous and the kids have the flu and my husband would never get another flight. So this was what she told
everyone
to say.
Happy, proud, and thrilled.
Exactly.
And how long did the Life connection last?
It lasted basically until Life folded. So throughout the program, you know, into the early 70s.
Was Life providing ghostwriters for the wives?
They were. Loudon Wainwright was one of those writers. A woman named Dodie Hamblin, who was very flamboyant and would smoke out of this long cigarette holder and really had a soft spot for the wives.
So did the wives object to the way they were being portrayed in retrospect?
No, they really saw Life as a protector. Life wanted to serve them up to the rest of the country as sort of a slice of apple pie with a scoop of vanilla ice cream on top. And let the wives and their husbands edit the copy, etc.
What had their lives been like before these men were chosen to be astronauts?
Well, not very easy. They were test pilot wives.
So they already were living with husbands who were had dangerous jobs.
Absolutely. Betty and Gus Grissom once had a conversation when he was a test pilot, and he never wanted her to wear black. He saw it as a morbid color, you know, and was superstitious about the nature of his job, as many of these husbands and wives were. He once told Betty Grissom, you know, if I die, I want you to have a party. And she promised her husband, okay, you know, we'll have a party. And Gus will later die in the Apollo 1 fire, sort of NASA's first large-scale tragedy.
So did you have the party?
Well, she didn't wear black to his funeral.
These people all had lives that went beyond the space race. Marilyn Lavelle found out that she was pregnant right before her husband Jim was assigned to the Gemini 7 mission.
She did, and she was afraid that Jim would be taken off that flight if NASA found out. So she kept her pregnancy a secret for as long as possible, even from Jim. He finally found out when she woke him up one night because she was nibbling on crackers. She was hiding under her pillow, and he was like, "What's that noise?" And she was like, "I'm sorry, I'm pregnant." And she explained to him why she had kept it secret, and he was like, "You know what? That's a great idea, and we should keep it under wraps for as long as possible."
Now, how did they work out the double locations? They were living outside of Houston?
Yeah. The astronaut families all were living in the Clear Lake area, and it was a collection of subdivisions. Timber Cove was where most of the Mercury astronauts lived, John and Annie Glenn and the Carpenters, and then there was Alago and Nassau Bay. The astronauts were training at Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy later, during the week, and they would fly these hot jet trainers, T-38s, to and from.
And that's why they also had to contend with the Cape Cookies you mentioned earlier. How did the Mercury 7 wives refer to themselves as the Astronaut Wives Club? They got together to kind of share experiences, to commiserate?
Well, the club is both a metaphor and a real society. And it starts in the beginning with just this group of seven women being thrust into this new role, getting very little support from NASA. And so they decided they had to sort of rise above their husband's competition and band together. So they were, as they've told me, sort of sisters, space sisters, as I suggested to Joe Sharon. She agreed.
Did they invite the wives of future astronauts into the club?
Yeah, so later when you have the Gemini and Apollo astronauts coming in the 60s, it becomes too big of a group to remain informal. And so they had monthly teas and coffees and get-togethers, sort of Tupperware and cigarettes and martini gatherings, where they tried to support each other as much as they could.
Because the other side, as we've kind of mentioned earlier, is that this was very dangerous. And in fact, one of the wives even renamed launch reports the Death Watch.
Exactly. That was basically because they always felt that the press was waiting for a high and often dramatic moment to cover. In one case, Jane Conrad, Pete Conrad's wife, who is the third man to walk on the moon, heard a reporter saying, put the microphone by her window so we hear her if she screams.
Wow. That's kind of ghoulish. So how did these were all marriages that were suddenly under a microscope? That's always difficult.
It was very difficult. And there was no divorce even allowed within NASA until it erupts in 1969 and was covered around the world as the first space divorce. This happens between Don and Harriet Isley. And after that, it's almost like a domino effect, and you get a lot of skeletons coming out of the closet. And many of the marriages after the men went to the moon, after their flight was secured, many of the marriages sadly fell apart.
Do you think because of all the attention or simply because of all the other pressures that were inherent in the program?
I think it was largely the emotional cost of the program. I mean, you have a hero father, who's hero husband, who's often an absentee father at home. These guys are training around the clock, and often, even though they're smiling in the pages of Life magazine, things were really falling apart back on Earth. Buzz and Joan Aldrin went on this fabulous round-the-world tour with all of the Apollo 11 families after the moon landing. And at one point, Joan, who was his wife and an amateur actress, said to him, you know, I think that things will finally return to normal. You know, that's my hope. And he looked at her and he said, you know, Joan, I've been to the moon. Nothing's ever going to be the same.
Well, what was it like for their kids?
Well, in a way, it was sort of a slice of the American dream. It was like when reporters would ask them back in the day, what is it like having an astronaut father? They'd be like, yeah, it's no big deal. My best friend around the corner, across the street, his dad's an astronaut too. You know, they usually wanted to watch Star Trek, and their mothers were trying to get them inside to watch their daddy's launch.
On the other hand, their father would have said, well, there is a difference. I've been to the moon. Lily Coppell's latest book, her follow-up to her bestseller, The Red Leather Diary, is The Astronaut Wives Club. It is published by Grand Central. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.